Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb. Today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. The Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. Please go to 1517.org/podcast to see everything we are offering. We have a couple of new shows right now. We have Christian History Almanac, which is a 5-minute daily show that is very playfully written segments of church history. Some of it's really obscure, some of it's well known, and it's just told really well. The other show that we have out that's brand new is called For You Radio, which is actually a radio program in the Cleveland, Ohio area. And that's part of our podcast network too now, which is a 35 to 40 minute episode on Christian theology and practice. So that goes up every week as well, so you can check that show out. We also have a new season of Cindy Koch's Family Style Theology that's coming out soon. So again, 1517.org/podcasts, and you can see everything that we're offering there. All right, guys, we are doing sort of a break in between series right now. And I thought it would be good to hit on apologetics since we haven't done a lot of it. And we did, I think, what was a very great intro episode for not only just making the case for apologetics in general, but there was a lot of sort of good personal anecdotes about how this has played out in real life and how the various ways in which apologetics impacts life and not just sort of as a formal argumentation all the time. And so with that, Dr. Francisco, I'm going to give him credit where credit's due, came up with this idea that, hey, we did a series where we sort of outlined everything. Why don't we just sit back and have a conversation about it? And so I'm just going to throw out a question and let everybody talk.
It's good to give credit because if it bombs, now you can say it was his idea.
Yeah. 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 Why are you going to throw me on the
people are like,
assignment of blame.
Yeah.
People are like,
preemptively.
The Thinking Fellows is a fine academic show. Why'd you have to ruin it by being conversational? So here's a question for today. We had a couple questions that we discussed as possible during the break. I'm gonna go with this one. How or why do we know anything at all? How do you know anything is true? How do we know that this table isn't a figment of my imagination?
The late Jim Sire of InterVarsity wrote a book that I used as a textbook for several years, called Why Should Anyone Believe Anything at All? S-I-R-E, Jim Sire, James Sire. And it sort of tackles some of these in a way that intro to philosophy wouldn't or doesn't. That's worth considering. We don't carry it, but you can find it. And it's down at that basic level and probably applies very much to the younger generation, millennials or younger, who've had to endure schools that I don't want to comment on.
But you're just going to withhold.
Yeah. Why should anyone believe anything? Now, ideally, an intro to Phil should do some of that. It really should. But they probably won't take a course like that.
If you have a Phil prof that believes anything, that is.
Yeah. And at some level, some of this is just really practical. I think with the sort of the transgender stuff going around, sometimes you ask, why should I believe you are what you claim you are?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you a woman? Why are you a man? You have to be able to point to anything, something. Got to be able to explain yourself a little bit.
That'll always be autobiographical. The answer to it will always be autobiographic.
If you're if you're legit asking me, you know, why do I believe anything at all? I mean, that's saying why do you believe anything is kind of a hard starting point.
It is. It's pretty rough.
The fact is that I do, right? And the fact is that everybody does. And I think that's where Sire starts, really, is acknowledging that everybody believes something.
Yep.
And I think,
or at the very least, believes in their own existence.
As far as universal statements go, that's a pretty good one. Because the moment somebody pops up and says, I don't believe anything, and I don't think anybody else can either, well, you've just, given me your creed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
that's right.
So for me, it's a different. It's a different starting point. The bigger question that I have been asked is, how do you know what to believe? You know, and that's a more legitimate question. You could say that another way. Why do you believe the things that you do believe?
Yeah.
That's a bigger, more legitimate question. Well, if somebody were to ask me, why do you believe anything at all? I'd be like, well, you know, this is, it's sort of, I think throughout history shown to be the natural state of humanity that we do believe stuff. And the bigger question is, how do we know what to believe? Or said another way, how do we know what we believe is true? That's a more important question.
I think it's one that sort of naturally comes out of the fact that there is just conflict in every human relationship that we have. We disagree or have various beliefs on a whole bunch of things, and there is a desire for, I mean, not in every circumstances, but in a lot of those circumstances, for one to come out on top. And we might say some things like some art, something like that.
Yeah, this goes back to Aristotle and before, but he put it together in a way it hadn't been done prior. But you don't have to do this in religious circles.
It's not a religious question.
It's not a religious question.
It's a branch of philosophy called epistemology.
Yeah.
And there's two questions to be asked when you're discussing epistemology. What is knowledge, and can we have knowledge? Mm-hmm. If your automatic answer to the second question, can we have knowledge, is no, conversation over.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's a position. It's called skepticism. It's called maybe even extreme skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing an apologetic with an extreme skeptic in that sense, you know, it's fairly easy because the conversation has now gotten contentious. Right, if somebody just looks at you and says, well, you can't know anything. Okay, that's fairly contentious. And it's fairly easy in turn to say, well, you've just made a universal statement of truth.
Yeah that one is.
So how do we deal with the fact that I can't know anything, but you know this universally?
Well, yeah, how do you know that I don't know?
Yeah.
Like, it's, I mean, that kind of becomes an endless circle.
It is. It's why the really, in truth, there are no true skeptics. I mean, there are people, I think, who play devil's advocate.
Yes.
Skepticism.
A lot.
But
they have to function in everyday life, which means that they trust that something's going to happen. They trust that their car turns on. They trust that they're going to be able to get to point A to point B, that their paycheck is going to...
They trust that when they open their mouth to say there is no truth, that the words are going to come out.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all sorts of things that you could point to.
But living in the real world, that gets hard. Every time you stop at a four-way stop and wait for the guy on your right to go first, everything you're doing is arguing against your position.
Well, people don't do that anymore. There's no...
Whoa. It's there's circle no lefts, man.
No, there's no more positional consistency, I think, what you're saying.
It's just sort of people go whenever they want to go.
But that's, I thought you were saying something else. I think what people don't do anymore is give a hoot.
Oh, yeah.
If their position is completely inconsistent with life.
Yeah.
They call it
cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
In real life, they live one way, but when it comes to beliefs and things like that, it's something totally different.
Yeah. There used to be a word for that, but it wasn't cognitive dissonance. It was another word that we don't use anymore.
Oh, no. So, I don't know. I mean, this is one of the things that bothers me, is somebody will try to use, say, high-level reasoning to argue that there's no God or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have, like, the basic epistemological questions down, like, Why do you drive what car you drive?
But that's a different question. And this gets back to the last episode.
I don't know. It's a car. I like it.
This gets back to the last episode. The people who say, okay, we can know everyday stuff.
Yep.
But we can't know the other, right?
Yep.
Religious belief.
Yeah.
They're actually, that's also in conversation, I think, a fairly easy one to talk about, because then you can, especially if you're a Christian, because you say, okay, well, let's talk about the everyday stuff. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about whether or not a dude actually died.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
And you can, it's a presumption that what you're trying to talk about when it comes to theology or religion is only discussing the other, the unknowable, or the quasi-knowable, or the knowable through other types of language or whatever. But that's not what you're doing in this situation. You're actually, when you're talking about Christianity, you're really having a discussion over stuff that everyday stuff that you can know or not know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a sort of Kantian approach, you're always trying to get through the ceiling and you never make it. But he should have known, growing up as a Lutheran in his century, aren't you going to talk about the possibility that the noumenal could crash down to our world, the phenomenal world?
I just had a flashback to sitting in this little crappy classroom at Concordia University, and Rod Rosenblatt
doing the same hand
drawing the picture of the ceiling on the whiteboard. Sorry.
Those were some of the best days of my life.
And describing Kant through the crashing through this ceiling on the whiteboard. Sorry, I've had a flashback.
Yeah, well, I mean, all I'm getting at is I think there's one of the first things that people are going to run into is people haven't even considered a lot of the everyday questions anymore, right? Like, it's all sort of preference. There isn't a reason why I bought this car or why I live in this city. That's
or
just
I'm
the
not
way
interested.
Things are.
Yeah, I'm not interested in asking either.
Yeah.
That's called determinism.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, in that sense, it's not real.
Yeah, why do you live in Orange County? I don't know. My parents live here. Well, why does your dad live here? Whose work brought you here? What do you do in town?
Like, that's not how do you know anymore. That's just people not thinking about their life.
Yeah. But I think that's the first step to this. I mean, if somebody who hasn't questioned the basic everyday parts of their life, where does my food come from even? I mean, you hear politicians like about issues with getting food to big cities or saying there shouldn't be rural cities anymore. We should all move into big cities. Like, okay, great. So where are you going to get your cows? Like, where are you going to get where are you going to get vegetables? Where are you going to get?
My dad bought a farm for us complete with animals, horses and cows and all that. And one of the reasons was he didn't want us to believe that food came from a grocery store.
Mm.
We stayed up one night until 1 in the morning waiting for a calf to be born so we could watch it, and finally we had to go to bed.
Wow.
But that was part of why he got it for us, so we wouldn't believe what most city kids believe.
Yeah.
We have chickens in our backyard, and we're literally behind our house is a big berm, and across the berm is the 5 freeway, which is probably one of the busiest freeways on
the planet.
Is that
fair?
I would guess so.
And we had one of our chickens was a rooster. And there's no benefit of having a rooster, and it might be illegal where I live. So my wife and I were, what do we do with this thing? I said, well, let's slaughter it.
You got to kill
and
the rooster.
Cook it. And sure enough, I held out the neck, and my son brought out a samurai sword and cut off the head.
Oh my gosh, did you have steel gloves on?
We put a beer can in its rear and put it on the grill, and it was stringy, but it was okay.
I love that you did the beer can thing because it just completes the picture.
It wasn't Miller Lite or whatever you drink, but
Miller Lite, my friend.
But it was that whole thing in a Orange County sort of way.
Trailer park living in Orange County.
Because if you just go to the local grocery store, you just sort of pick and choosing.
Sure.
And you take so much for granted.
Yep.
I do this vocation talk. In fact, I just did it in Minneapolis. There'll be a video of it. But I used to do it at Concordia for the first year students. As part of it, I discussed the fourth petition of the Lord's Prayer, which is "Give us this day our daily bread."
Mm.
And I used to ask the students, I'm like, how many of you guys pray this? You know, a bunch of hands go up. When you pray this, how do you think, if you think God answers prayer and that he's going to answer this prayer when you ask him to, how do you think this happens? And inevitably, you know, you get blank stares. And so I focus on sort of one aspect of it, which is how many tractor trailer trucks it takes to haul food into Orange County a day, just so that when we pray, give us this day our daily bread, God can, if we live in Orange County, God can answer that prayer with a yes, you know, and you focus on just that one thing and say that it takes 150, you know, each semi, there's about 6 million people, I think, each semi truck can hold about 40,000 pounds. Each person eats, 3 million people. Each person eats 2 pounds of food a day. That takes 150 tractor trailer trucks or a line of trucks a mile and a half long, just so that God can answer your prayer when you say, give us this day our daily bread. Now,
good illustration.
That's outstanding.
Apologetically, you know, or just in conversational life, most people don't think of what it takes for the food to get to the grocery store. And even most Christians, when they pray, give us this day our daily bread, don't actually... It's kind of just like, oh, it's just something we say.
It's all abstract.
Yeah, but if you're actually asking for God to give you daily food, you know, some of this requires thought. And just because, you know, the logistics have all been handled by some, God has used someone else to handle all the logistics. Well,
you're asking to have a place to live. Yes. You're asking for somebody to have a job to be able to afford food or to grow it. You're asking for other people for grocery stores to be around. You're asking for truck drivers to be, I mean, you're asking for a whole slew of things.
But I think you're right. You know, and if you say a word like, you know, epistemology, people, they snap out of it. But in the last show, I talked about how when I learned this stuff from Rod 25 years ago, it's not just apologetics that came together for me or how to defend the faith that came together for me or theology that came together. All of a sudden, you see it's comprehensive that these decisions that you make in life, in the civil life too, you know, it can all plug into this. Mm-hmm. You know, I can answer, why do I drive that car? Why do I live there? And what are the benefits and the downfalls to living up on a mountain and all, you know, because it's, I've learned to think about it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think it's just difficult because I feel like a lot of people don't, and maybe that's just sort of like some sort of martyr complex people get, but like you said, you have to, when I moved up to the mountain, you had to think about what that meant for getting to work.
Absolutely.
just this winter, we realized that all three roads up to the mountain can close.
Or were closed.
Yeah, they did. I moved up there sort of knowing that was a possibility.
Yeah.
But when it happened, it was like, oh, wow, we can't.
You literally could leave if you wanted to. I mean,
we could have. You would have been. You would have had to get past police officers.
But I could have found a dirt road.
Yeah,
you need a truck, Caleb.
Yeah, yes. Nah. Yes. But it. I don't know.
I remember. I'm going to put Dr. Rosenblatt on the spot. Not on the spot. But yeah. I remember at graduation at Concordia University Irvine, I had a brief conversation with Dr. Rosenblatt, and he probably doesn't remember because he's a humble guy and so on. But those distinctions you talked about last episode, you know. Analytic, synthetic, and meaningless claims, and
world-changing.
I mean, just changes you. It helps you just be reasonable.
Yes.
It helps you, in a way, kind of do what Luther suggested was the meaning of the first article of the creed. God has given me my reason and my sense experience, and still preserves them.
Yeah, wow, that's a different translation than I remembered. But yeah,
well, you know,
I like it.
I play fast and loose.
So
it was huge. It's basic, but it is life-changing.
I mean, it changes.
The world has facts have.
Well, you'll never listen to some politician spouting off the same way again.
No,
that's for sure.
True. You know, on both sides,
automatically you can hear when somebody is making just a completely unverifiable statement that's meant to appeal to somebody's emotions.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
You know, and it's
my blood pressure rises when I listen to politics, so I don't listen to it.
But I do want to acknowledge. I don't think it's a martyr complex for a lot of people. I think like there are people in my life that I love very much that haven't had this sort of experience and haven't had somebody teach them all these things. And they do go through life, I'd say, with a bit more faith, in a sort of blind faith sort of sense. And I don't think they're insincere about that. I just think that they've not, you know, one, they're not sort of wired the same way even if they've heard it before, they're not wired in the same way that I am, that it like clicked and I'm like, oh, this, I have to incorporate this into part of who I am. Or two, they haven't heard it and they're just sort of doing what they were taught to do by their parents or by teachers or all of the above. I really wish, you know, more people would live a more examined life than they do. But I don't think that for people, many people that don't, that it's a martyr complex. I just think that, you know, there's probably a host of variables why they don't, and it's individual to each person.
Oh no, I was saying my complaining of it.
In a way, we're kind of fortunate to live in a nation, a society that works this way,
or values these.
Yeah, I mean, these things. Yes.
Or valued. But
the downside though is you forget about the cost.
That
it took to get here.
Yep.
Yeah.
The cost in blood.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think we all forget about that.
Years ago, I made a sort of a determination. If I ever see a guy or a woman in uniform at the airport, I'm going to go over and shake their hand and thank them.
Yeah. You won't find them in uniform anymore, though. Mm. Well, not much, because of the now ISIS and other organizations like that get the they're targeting people.
Mm. Really? So,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I haven't seen a person in uniform in a long time.
Now that you say that, in the airport, I haven't either.
Yeah,
it's, you know, someday we could do a little bit on one of the shows about ourselves and the thesis. That idea is so stupid, only an intellectual could hold it.
Oh, Lord.
That would be beautiful. Let's do, as can I say it now? As a,
I got one religious
person
language.
Who's done with the academic world, at least in the university.
I mean,
setting?
No, seriously, I have one. The neo-orthodox religious language. Uh-huh. Only an academic could could say, well, this is real, but it's not real in the way that everything else is real. It's a special kind of event, and it's a special kind of language. Only an academic would come up with that. Period, the end. No normal person would. Only an academic.
I don't know if it was J.P. O'Rourke or G.K. Chesterton or somebody in between, but this idea of the open mind, somebody said, you don't want to be so open-minded, though, that your brains fall out. And that's what happens to a lot of academics. What? Anyway.
That would be a good episode.
That would be good. I just wish academics and pastors and theologians would just have like a hobby or do something in the real world also. Like go outside, like farming or working on your car or riding a bike, shoot traps, something mechanical, something get your hands dirty. Something out of the office, away
from
books.
Where they're watching baby calves be born.
Because you hear people start talking in flowery language, and then you ask them what they do, and they say, oh, I just read. I'm like, that's great. Okay, that's cool. But do you do anything? Do you?
Doing is important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whether it's mowing the lawn or changing your brake pads or
raising your kids
or brewing beer.
Yeah.
Doing something.
You can list off a million.
Who was that guy? I think one of you recommended to me motorcycle maintenance.
The classic shop class is Soulcraft.
That it.
That's by Matthew B. Crawford.
Yep.
It's phenomenal.
Yep.
It really is. It's an argument for, and it's secular, but it's an argument as an academic arguing for never making sort of your field of academic study your entire life, that you have to do something else. And that in doing so, your academic life is more enriched than you could ever imagine by doing other things. And even your ability to reason, he discusses in there, because what he does is he restores vintage BMW motorcycles. And he's a PhD from the University of Chicago in political philosophy.
Ooh.
Wow. What a combo.
Yeah.
And so he discusses how much, you know, his graduate studies in philosophy come into play when he's trying to problem solve an issue with a 1962 BMW motorcycle. Mm-hmm. You know, how much reasoning and logic and whatnot has to come into play to do that, and how doing that makes him better at political philosophy.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's phenomenal.
You know why theologians get away with not having to do this? Because what could be more important than God? I mean, it's simply the amount of times I've heard that. What could be more important than devoting more of my time to the study of God?
Teaching your son how to change the oil on his car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Raising children. Amen.
Raising your children.
Amen.
Yeah. And in so doing, know that you're doing so to the glory of God.
Yep.
Oh, where'd that come from?
Yeah. Sorry, I drove us off track, but
no, not really. How does sort of caring about any part of the world around you relate to universal truth claims or truth or the combativeness of truth claims?
So this just really quickly. There's a tendency among academics, maybe Christians, to move into the abstract realm.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And when you're doing with your hands or your feet or having to deal with the horizontal realm, that keeps you from abstract.
Yes.
I mean, the term I would use is ideological thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, thinking where it's just all ethereal, it's all floating out there and not corresponding to the world of fact.
Yep.
That's more of the philosophical answer, maybe.
I think it's the right answer, saying it's grounding.
Well, Dr. Montgomery has one that we discussed when he was here. Several of us, the setting against one another, speculation and facticity.
Mm. Yes.
And it's all over the place.
Yes.
It's all over the place.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I think that for Christianity, it's absolutely natural to wrestle with the how do we know of the real world and in our everyday life and connect it to how do we know in our faith, because it's not a religion of the ethereal. It's not a religion of the other. It's a religion of a guy that was actually incarnate, a man walking around, living a life, having friends, having family, getting dirty, getting bloody, getting sore feet, being hungry. He's not the other. It's not the, and so whenever we make sort of any of these discussions about, well, how do we know the other? It's for Christians, it's almost irrelevant because we know by knowing the Christ who was here.
Yep.
And who was attested to by people who were also there.
Yep.
And who shared with us their actual written testimony.
You know, what you're saying makes me think of the the early church. And in the early church, after the apostles died, it was no problem to say Jesus was fully God. Done. But when you said Jesus was fully human, fully a man, that was a problem.
Yeah, that's still, and it still is, I think.
Yeah.
I think it still is. The worst thing that's ever happened to our ability to, quote unquote, know as Christians has been Gnosticism, has been the monastic movement, everything within Christianity, which has moved our emphasis from the God who is incarnate in Christ to the other.
Yep. Mm. I think we see a lot of that in American Christianity through sort of what we've talked about, prosperity things Jesus take the wheel type of stuff, sort of divine intervention. The expectation is sort of divine intervention into life.
Now.
Well, I think it.
I hear this stuff like
You could point out examples in Lutheranism where this is becoming more and more
popular. I've heard, heaven, the heaven homesickness and things like that.
I never heard that before.
It just.
I think
I did notice you critique Carrie Underwood a bit, and I would caution. Leave her alone.
Well, you've heard me tell this before. One time, Dr. Horton, the microphones were off. Mike looked at me and said, "What do you think is the endemic American religion?" I said, "Mormonism." He said, "I used to think that too, but I don't anymore." I said, "What do you think it is?" He said, "I think it's Gnosticism."
Yeah, I do too.
I think it's made its way into almost every church in America, including our own, through sort of worship language and things like that. I don't know, a lot of service language. I think.
Well, you can even see it to Rod's point. You can, outside of the church, and I'm sure I haven't read Dave Zoll's Seculosity yet, but I'm sure in a way it'll be an argument for everyone in America is religious because they're so Gnostic, right? But you can see it in some of the most secular examples. The one you pointed out to me the other day of the pro snowboarder felt guilt over traveling to Switzerland or something and then heli-skiing, taking helicopter rides to the top and snowboarding down because he had been sort of chiding his friends for the last several years to become more carbon neutral. And he, all of a sudden, somebody pointed out to him that even that one trip,
he tracked it was like 16 tons of carbon.
Burned like 600 lifetimes worth of carbon in one trip. And he's all of a sudden guilty, right? He's got this other than guilt because he's offended the gods of global warming or whatever. And his solution to this is to buy carbon offsets, right?
Yeah.
The solution is essentially
donate money to
tenants to buy indulgences.
They're buying indulgences.
Yeah.
This reminds me of a book, Eric Vagelin's Science, Politics, and Gnosticism. And that's the argument there. It's a couple decades old now, maybe 30 or 40 years, but that we've all become Gnostics.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
Philosophical questions always have a religious implication.
It's hard for me to imagine, but in those days in church history, all of a sudden, verses like Jesus was thirsty.
Yeah.
Or hungered.
Yeah.
Or was wearied. All of those verses were everything. And we're in, you know, another situation, or have been, where Jesus' deity is on the line.
Yeah.
And not in the early church. Mm-hmm. It was all those things that referred to as humanity.
Well, recently, that's what's coming back into line, too, is that, you know, not only his humanity, but his human existence, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Oh, well, just to get things back on track here, I think that, which is hard. No, I think what I'm hearing is that the sort of the normalcy or the tangibility of Christianity lets us open up with questions like, how do I know that what I believe or what I do is true? And not start from...
Well, I would say this. Christians ought not be afraid of the question, how do we know anything?
No, yeah. That's right.
Of all religions,
right.
Christians ought not be afraid of this question, because the answer to it will be the same answer as how we know anything in our everyday life.
Yes,
if you can sort of figure out how you know anything in everyday life, and it's probably going to be by trusting some authority, and you probably have some mental schema for how you decide who or what to trust and who or what not to trust. You know, if you can kind of think of that as a Christian, that same schema can be applied to Christianity, and it's going to come out in very good shape.
Yep.
And
other religions or religions won't.
Yeah, they won't. And so for the Christian, I mean, to bring this all around, the question, how do you know anything, ought not be a scary one, because most of the times you'd be scared because you see the implication coming, right? How do you know your faith is true?
Yeah.
Don't be afraid of that. It's the answer to that question is going to be the same as, you know, how do you know
getting on this plane was going to be,
or how did you know your car was going to be in the garage when you went out there in the morning, or whatever, you know. How do you know any historical testimony that you trust in is true, whatever.
Yeah. Paul at Mars Hill, Acts 17, I think it's verse 31, concludes his speech to the Stoic and Epicurean philosophers, the major, the two philosophies of the Roman world in the first century AD. And he says, these things are true, I'm paraphrasing here, because God has risen his son from the dead.
Boom.
And the Greek word there is pistin, which is normally translated faith. But Paul uses it, or Luke, who's writing Acts, uses it as, NASB translates it very well. This is the proof that all this is true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I mean,
we will always get people who have decided they can cause us trouble by always saying, but why, but why, but why, but why. It doesn't mean they've necessarily thought it through themselves.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of mean, but I like it.
I mean, for me, this might be even some like a call to some listeners to maybe do this with smaller things in your life more often. You don't have to start with the big one. Ask yourself, how do I know that my car is going to start tomorrow morning?
Yep.
And you probably do know that it's going to start tomorrow morning, but start to think about why.
Well,
you own a Ford.
I'll do you one better. You don't know that it will in the way that you think you know that it will. In other words, if you start to think about it, you'll think of the reasons why it might not start.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find out that even though you take it for granted that you go out in the garage and you start it up every morning and it starts, that you don't actually know that to be true like you know 2 + 2 = 4.
Right. Yes.
You'll find out that you know it to be true in another way. You'll know it to be true that you believe that in all likelihood it will start.
Yep.
Because it has started the past 100 times you've tried to start it, but you will also remember a time when you were at a Motel 6 in 1982 and you came out to your car to start it up and it didn't start.
Yep.
You couldn't have driven in 1982. You were 10 years old. There is a theory going around that you try to make yourself sound older than you are.
Really? No. I can tell you, I changed my first battery out of my mother's car when I was 10 years old in Ventura, California at the Motel 6 off the C-word. So,
boom. I want to fist bump you.
Bam.
Ooh. Wow.
I got second battery when I was 13 in Bakersfield, California at my grandmother's house.
Whoa. You should write.
I should have.
But it's sort of a non-abstract way of saying what one philosopher said. That is, we live by probabilities.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Absolutely.
Same thing you just said.
Yeah. So you do know it to be true that your car will start, but you don't know it in the way that you probably think you do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and for those reasons, I have one car that I'm pretty sure is going to start more of the times than the other one. And that's I am more confident that my newer car will start than the older one.
Absolutely true. That's great.
Yeah.
This reminds me of the Jeep I sold about a week ago. If it didn't start, I just had to open up the hood, which is a pain, because and just tap the battery cable.
Really?
And it would
start
up.
Really easy fix to that. Yeah. We had that in Josh's truck. Yeah. Yeah. It's at a washer.
Oh, yeah, a washer. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, now we're talking about fixing that. Hey, thank you for listening to this episode of the Thank You Fellows. If you have questions for us, if you have something you want us to discuss, something you've thought about or you wanted to discuss with people, please send it our way. We're happy to look over questions and do this. We're about to get into a 6-episode series on Christianity in America. When that's over, we're going to hop back into more questions like this. We're going to do things of an apologetic nature. I've got some theological ones that I want to do, even some philosophical ones that I want to do. Adam has... he gets a lot of credit for some of this new...
Especially since it worked out.
Yeah, since it worked out. This new simple question-based format. He's even been working on some stuff with sort of pop-level philosophy in the United States today, which I actually think would be fun to engage with and see how it relates back to Christianity or if it's compatible or how so. So thanks for listening to this. Keep on sending ideas our way. And if you have been listening to the show, if it has been a good resource for you, please consider giving us a monthly donation through 1517. It's 1517.org. There's a donate button at the top there. You can select an amount. And again, like I said, monthly reoccurring donations really do help us build in the long run. It helps us see who's out there listening and who this is of value to, that we should and that we can keep producing it. All right, thank you. Bye.